mood on the streets was extremely excited and extremely volatile. There were mob scenes as he came through the crowds, and obviously a great deal of people are expecting very much from him. It's always the problem when a returning leader comes home at this particular juncture. How do you calm the fever of passion that people want to go on from this revolution on to something further? They all feel that the revolution hasn't really finished, and of course the Ayatollah's aides, who are perhaps a little more radical than he is, want to push it on a little bit further themselves.
That's an ABC report from early 1979, as the Shiite leader Ayatollah Khomeini returned to his homeland of Iran. In February 79, the US-backed Shah, or King, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, had fled after a year of uprisings. Then, on April the 1st, 1979, after a national referendum, the Ayatollah Khomeini officially declared Iran an Islamic Republic, and that impact reverberates today. US journalist Robin Wright spent much of the 70s in Iran, and she returned many times after the revolution. In 1989, she wrote a definitive account called In the Name of God, The Khomeini Decade. Robin Wright recalls the conditions that led to the revolution.
In the movement by both of the Pahlavi Shahs to modernize Iran, they moved very far, very fast, without the kind of respect to traditions within religious institutions or for cultural traditions that had defined Iranian history for millennia. So that led eventually to the emergence of Ayatollah Khomeini, who in 1963 became famous in a rather advanced age in life over the issue of U.S. influence and an agreement between Iran and the United States that gave immunity to thousands of American forces who served in Iran, immunity from prosecution for whether it was a felony or a misdemeanor. And this outraged Iranians, who felt that they didn't want foreigners to have more rights than they did. And so this led Khomeini to become a national figure. And as a result of that, the Shah expelled him, thinking that would end the issue. And of course, over the next 14 years, Khomeini mobilized millions of followers, and he became the face of a revolution that originally had many different political components, leftists and liberals, as well as Marxists and nationalists. It was not an Islamic revolution initially. It was led by Khomeini as a unifying factor for all these different forces. But it took another year and a half after the revolution to become an Islamic Republic.
You first went there, I think, as a very young reporter in 1973. Did you, 6 years before the revolution, sense the stirring, though? Did you sense the rising tide of religiosity?
I think across the Middle East, one saw the rise of Islam as a force of political opposition. None of us saw it as a potential source of modern governance. It was clear after the 1973 war that Islam was becoming, because of the failure of secular ideologies, a much more potent force in rallying people to various causes. The Iranian Revolution was a byproduct of that mood across the Middle East. Of course, in Shiite Islam, the clergy has far more powers in interpreting God's word for the individual than in Sunni Islam, where the relationship between man and God or woman and God is direct. In Shiite Islam, the clergy interprets God's word, and therefore, when it came to the credibility of the clerics as a voice in earthly demands, the Ayatollah was a logical option. And he became a very potent force using the very modern mechanisms of tape cassettes and fax machines, even though he was in exile, in getting his message back to Iran.
As you say, it was a broad coalition of groups and individuals that toppled the Shah. I'm wondering how much the sort of secular left was willing to cede leadership to someone like the Ayatollah.
Well, I think after the revolution, you could see the deep divisions among the various factions as they began to sort out What kind of government were they going to create? What kind of new constitution were they going to write? And there were such deep divisions that many of the leftists and liberals boycotted the process in the end, boycotted the final vote. And that made it much easier for the clerics to push through a constitution that was modeled largely on French and Belgian law, but had a large section that created parallel institutions so that for the presidency, you found it mirrored by a supreme leader who had the ultimate power. The parliament was mirrored by a 12-man council of guardians that could veto candidates, could overrule legislation. You had the traditional civilian criminal courts, but there were also Islamic courts that could charge people with kind of vague Islamic crimes. And that has always been the big issue that's defined 40 years of the revolution. Which branches, the secular institutions defined by kind of Western values, Western models, or the Islamic courts, which branch of government should have the ultimate say? In other words, is the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is its formal name, first and foremost Islamic, or is it first and foremost a republic? And everything in Iran, domestic policy, foreign policy, has played out over that central tension.
You kept going back to Iran for many years after the revolution. How quickly, Robin, did Iranian society change after the revolution?
Well, within the first year, you saw very striking changes, particularly in the Cultural Revolution that changed the nature of education, the demands on women to wear headscarves or coverings. In the early days, the restrictions were very tight. You couldn't show any hair at all. There were moral police who would stop couples on the street and make sure that they were married. There's no public display of affection, no drinking, no socializing, no bars, no alcohol. It eliminated many of the things that had been introduced during the reform movement by the Shahs.
One of the points that you made in your book, and it still resonates with me today, is where you say that virtually no part of the world has been untouched by the revolution's repercussions. I think that is as true today as it was in 1990 when you wrote it. How did the Islamic Revolution of 79 resonate around the world?
Well, first of all, Iran proved to be one of the three defining revolutions of the modern era that gave us the three defining ideologies of the modern era. The French Revolution gave us democracy. The Soviet Revolution gave us communism. The Iranian Revolution introduced Islam as a form of governance. That has then played out in ways never envisioned in the early months of the revolution, in affecting whether it was the type of modern warfare, the introduction of hostage taking and suicide bombers, both practices that have been adopted in asymmetric wars around the world, the willingness to stand up to a superpower. In the 1970s, this was a defining time for the United States. Three events, the Vietnam War, Watergate and the resignation of President Nixon, and then the Iranian hostage ordeal and the taking of the American embassy. For the first time, one of the world's two major powers felt very vulnerable, and Iran was responsible for that. Iran also, in terms of introducing Islam, has changed the face of politics in more than 50 countries that have majority populations who are Muslim.
And two comments sort of resonate with me. One is this idea that I heard where today Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, is as defiant as ever. But then The Economist also says, look, Iran today is a much less pious place than the mullahs would like. How does that resonate with you as someone who's been a long-term observer and expert on Iran?
It's so very true. I remember in the early days going to Iran during the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, and I remember having very pale pink nail polish on. And the steward on the Iranian airplane said, oh, no nail polish, no nail polish. and I had no nail polish remover with me. And so he gave me 10 Band-Aids to put over my fingers so I could get into the country. I remember the immigration officials asking me, oh, are you badly injured? And when I got to Iran, I couldn't find any nail polish remover. So I got some kind of, oh, it's kind of smell like gasoline. It was horrible, just to get the color off. And it kind of left my nails looking orange and more kind of colorful than they were with my pale pink nail polish. Today, you go to Iran and girls are wearing black nail polish and plenty of makeup. Their hijab headscarves are perched so far back on their heads that you wonder how the scarves are held up at all. The young girls particularly wear jeans. The hijabs are very colorful now. This is not a place the girls all wear black or colorless Islamic dresses. You know, in the early days of the revolution, Khomeini said there could be no music. I mean, no music, not just no singing or whatever. And now you find on the streets, the street bands. I went to a concert on one of the anniversaries of the revolution a couple of years ago, and I heard at the opera hall songs, the Beatles and ABBA and Frank Sinatra and Simon and Garfunkel. The male singer had a backup band of four female singers. Things have just changed dramatically.
Fascinating as always, Robin. Thank you very much for joining us on this special program as we examine the 40th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Robin Wright, now with The New Yorker and the Wilson Center, and author of In the Name of God, The Khomeini Decade. And you're with Andrew West.